Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon and welcome to this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. I want to draw to your attention that in the first hour of this program, I spoke about the great heritage of Cardinal Schönborn and his contribution to the Church. We're going to be talking about that specifically, amongst other news, with my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen, who joins us every week. He is Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News, and we talk about current events in light of Church teachings and Church news. One of the things that we will be talking about is, as I mentioned, Cardinal Schönborn. His resignation has formally been accepted by Pope Francis. He's now 80 years old, and this is going to signify the end of his term in the See of Vienna as Archbishop. Cardinal Schönborn, sure, he's made some, there have been certain statements that he's made in recent years, but his great legacy will forever be, I believe, and I might be wrong in saying this, so what I'm about to say isn't magisterial, but I sincerely believe that his great legacy will be the great monumental contribution that he and Pope Benedict XVI made in the universal catechism of the Catholic Church that we have. I don't have a lot of time to go into it in this hour, and that's why I encourage you to take a look at my first hour, but this gift is a treasure to the Church, and nothing short of the work of the Holy Spirit, nothing short of the inspiration of the glory of God, and it is without a doubt historically the most scripture-saturated catechism that's ever been produced, but also a catechism that so richly draws from the heritage of every ecumenical council that came before it, and all of the many of the papal documents that have come before it, and the voices of the Church Fathers that have come before it. All of this to unite together in this wonderful synthesis of the proclamation of our faith in engaging this present de-Christianized culture. We'll talk about other news as well with Matthew. And then after that, I want to talk with Sean McGee about the transformation of post-revolution America. Because when the British Parliament learned of the infamous Boston Tea Party, it responded with a series of measures that were designed to rein in that kind of insubordination in that seaport town. But the response of the colonists laid the groundwork for what we now remember as the American Revolution. Those early years transformed and solidified American identity and created the thrust with which we now enjoy the freedoms of being citizens of this great nation. And so we talk about all of this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, January 23rd. It's the feast of St. Marian Cope. And today's news is brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. A federal judge is temporarily blocking President Trump's executive order that aims to limit birthright citizenship. A Seattle U.S. district judge heard arguments today in a lawsuit filed by Arizona, Illinois, Oregon, and Washington. Trump signed the executive order Monday after being sworn back into office. The order would limit birthright citizenship to children born to at least one parent who is either a U.S. citizen or permanent resident. At least five different lawsuits have been filed over the executive order. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will go before Congress next week for his confirmation hearings following his nomination to head the Department of Health and Human Services. The Senate Finance Committee will hold a hearing on Wednesday. The Senate Health Committee will hold a courtesy hearing the following day. Only the Finance Committee will vote to advance RFK Jr.'s nomination to the full Senate. And iPhones with TikTok installed are listed for thousands of dollars on eBay. After a brief ban in the U.S., those who deleted or never downloaded TikTok have been left in the dark since it's not available on Apple and Google App Stores in the U.S. Some iPhone owners who have kept TikTok downloaded are now selling their used or brand new phones. One eBay user in Florida listed an iPhone 15 Pro Max with TikTok for $10,000 or best offer. Other phones with TikTok installed are listed between $500 and $25,000. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. As we mentioned, we are talking with my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen of EWTN News, and we are talking about current events in light of church teachings and church news. Matthew, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Oh, great to be with you. All of us are in D.C. anticipating the March for Life, so a major event every year. This year, it's every year is a little different, and it's been interesting to sort of track how the pro-life movement has developed over these years.
And in fact, that's where I'd like to open up. You being in D.C. is one thing. You enduring D.C. weather is another thing. And every year during the March for Life, the weather tends to be some of the worst colds that that D.C. experiences. And yet Catholics from across the country and sometimes across the world come to this event to stand for the unborn.
Well, that's right. I mean, two of the things that we can always anticipate with the March for Life is that it will be cold. Obviously, it's at the end of January, typically on January 22nd, but things were sort of shifted a bit because of the inauguration that took place. Mm-hmm. There's something wonderfully appropriate that this year it will be on the feast of Francis de Sales. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that we can always anticipate with great skill, I think, we know it will happen, is that the numbers of marchers will be significantly, almost hilariously, underrepresented or depicted by the mainstream media.
Oh, yeah.
If they mention the march at all.
Yeah, that's been a running joke of sorts for Catholics to wait till the day after the March for Life and to just see what kind of minimalistic to non-existent coverage mainstream media has provided for the march.
That's right. There's an interesting energy to this year's march, partly because of the change of administrations. Mm-hmm. Now, we always have to factor in that the Trump administration, Trump campaign, as it was running itself in 2024 under Donald Trump, mm-hmm. who, of course, won, tacked, maneuvered, added nuance, or in some cases kind of walked away from some of the positions they had on pro-life. But I think there is a genuine expectation that certainly compared to the now-gone Biden administration, that there will be a significant shift in policy on the life front and on a host of other areas. Now, there will be obvious areas of disagreement as well, but I mention all of that as a preface to say that according to news releases from the March for Life, Vice President J.D. Vance will be speaking at the 52nd annual march. So right from the get-go, this administration is clearly making a point in prioritizing the pro-life movement. And of course, J.D. Vance, a now internationally famous Catholic convert and vice president now, I think is certainly committed to the pro-life cause.
Right. And now their commitment to the pro-life cause gives us a tremendous amount of hope. And we ought to make that very clear that there is hope for the fight. Had Trump and Vance's political opponents won, they had made very clear that part of their promise was the attempt at least to codify the regulations enshrined in Roe. And so we can be thankful that that's not the case. However, we also need to not rest on our laurels as we encounter this fight.
Well, that's absolutely right. We know that post-Dobbs, the shift, the battlegrounds have in so many ways moved to the states, which is precisely, in many ways, the point of overturning Roe v. Wade on the terms of Dobbs. That has meant a strategic shift and at times a very important set of tactical shifts in how the pro-life movement has functioned. And there were, of course, last year a number of significant defeats of the pro-life cause. There were some victories as well.
Yeah.
All of that to say that the speakers tomorrow, the March for Life, and J.D. Vance will be one of them, are going to try very clearly to reiterate the importance of the cause of life. And one other speaker that really jumps out to me, the schedule for tomorrow, is the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
Mm.
He was somebody who did not in any sense post-Dobbs run away from the abortion issue.
Right.
We saw in a number of campaigns in the fall of 2022 candidates who were reluctant to go there, so to speak, who were reluctant to stand on, you used the phrase, laurels of the pro-life movement, but also to be very aggressive and firm in that position. DeSantis went in exactly the opposite direction. He owned that issue. And I think that was a test case for candidates going forward, certainly on these individual state levels. And that is a position, I think, that was bolstered, strengthened significantly, at least in terms of argumentation,
right,
by the fact that abortion, contrary to what the Kamala Harris campaign had wanted, proved to be relatively unimportant as an issue in the 2024 presidential election.
Yeah, yeah. And that's crucial to remember. Like you and I have talked about it, it seems like the economy might have been the biggest driving force. But just kind of putting a neat little bow on the question of the March for Life, even right now, as you and I are talking, thousands upon thousands of pilgrims are making their way to D.C. amidst this terrible weather for bus drivers, to say the least. And
that's
they're
right.
going there for the prayer vigil, which is happening tonight. It's happening,
mm-hmm.
I think it's happening at 5 p.m., so right now. And
that's right.
And they're preparing for the next day.
Yeah, exactly. So after they're finished listening to you, I would encourage everyone to go to EWTN.com, where we'll be our full coverage will be taking place. But you're making a really important point, Marcus, and that is, well, two things. The I would say, first, we thank the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of pro-life supporters.
Mm-hmm.
Of all stripes, of all faiths. Catholics obviously have a very significant role in the pro-life movement. The people of goodwill who are gathering in Washington and who are making their voices heard. Post-Dobbs, there were a lot of questions about whether the March for Life in D.C. should still be held. Well, the answer, of course, is firmly yes. We need these public witnesses. We need these public statements. Yeah. And then to send everyone home. And that's the other point, that to leave this event galvanized, to go back to your own families, to mm-hmm. your communities, to organize marches there, but to be active on the pro-life front.
Yeah.
Why? Because we are positioned now to achieve quite a lot of victory, but more than that, winning hearts and minds to the pro-life cause
yeah.
at a time when the radical positions of the pro-abortion movement are being made more and more self-evident.
Yep. This isn't just about making abortion unthinkable, even though that is the case. It's really about protecting children, protecting mothers and fathers, and ultimately protecting families.
Yeah, that's right. And it's bolstered by what we know are very clear public sentiments. We know, for example, the Knights of Columbus Marist poll that was released, that the vast majority of Americans support placing legal limits of some sort on abortion. 83% of Americans support pregnancy resource centers, and 62% believe that healthcare professionals with religious objections to abortion should not have to perform them. So, I mean, these are really significant numbers that position the pro-life movement to make serious inroads culturally with Americans who support them.
Yep. And there's so much by way of rhetoric that we can continue to talk about. I really have to pivot here to ask your input on the recent CARA findings, the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate at Georgetown University, in terms of allegations against clergy for child abuse.
Yeah, that's right. So for many, many years now, CARA, which is the Georgetown University Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate, has been doing these very important studies mm-hmm. on where we are in terms of the clergy sexual abuse crisis. The recent study that came out found that, as to use the technical term, dioceses, eparchies, and religious communities of men have spent about $5 billion in payouts since 2004. Now, that's a benchmark year because that was the year that, as a result of the bishops themselves moving the Dallas Charter and others coming on the heels also of the almost equally landmark John Jay study into
yeah.
this, that we've been tracking settlements but also allegations. Now, this is really important, I think, because while this is an immense sum paid out over two decades, most of this stems from 80% of the alleged crimes that took place in the 1980s
yep.
or prior.
My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, we are talking about church news, current events in light of church teaching, and we are continuing this conversation on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. As I mentioned earlier, we're talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen of EWTN News. We are talking about current events in light of church teachings and church news. So, Matthew, let's finish up what you and I were talking about pertaining to the Cara findings and especially payoffs. The payoffs, as you mentioned rightly, are relating to allegations that took place largely in the 1980s, in the late 70s into the 80s. So let's pick up from there.
Well, that's right. So why that matters most significantly is that these are allegations. So we're looking at about 16,000 allegations that were rendered credible or decided that were labeled credible. But those date back, those are historical. Now, that means that each year that we have seen this type of reporting, that allegations of abuse have dropped very sharply in the U.S. And throughout the course of the 20th century and then into this new century. So the point is, again, as Cara itself notes, that 9 in 10 of all credible allegations were said to have occurred or had begun in 1989 or earlier, and only 3% of the allegations were said to have taken place since 2000. Now, we always have to say that vigilance here has to be eternal. One case of abuse is too many. And this has been an absolute disaster for the church, certainly on multiple levels. But we are seeing the fruits of the measures and the steps that were taken by the U.S. bishops in implementing these norms, the essential norms, the charter, and then following through with those. And then, of course, we also have the papal decree under Pope Francis of Ossetius Lux Mundi that seeks to hold bishops more accountable and also expands the understanding of abuse to vulnerable adults.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are steps, important steps, in ending, fighting, and preventing the scourge of clergy sexual abuse. Now, the other aspect, too, is that 80% of the abuse victims were male. More than half were ages 10 to 14, and 20% were aged young or 9 or younger.
Right.
So again, this validates what were some of the immediate assumptions coming out of those earlier reports from almost 20 years ago now. But when we look at the trend lines, they're very positive. The trend lines indicate progress in this fight. But again, it's going to be a process of eternal vigilance, as I was saying.
Yep, a process of eternal vigilance and continued effort on the part of especially the church and the lay faithful to all make concerted efforts to make this a thing, not just of the past, but to never recur again. But in that light,
right. And it is that, that moving, looking ahead, that point needs to be made as well. Just how much money, time, and effort the church has now put into preventative measures. The church, in many ways, in the United States, is a gold standard for secular institutions in things like background checks and creating safe environments. Any diocese now will have to have in place, and does have in place, various measures. Now, can mistakes happen? Can loopholes be found by those who are determined to get around them? Yes, but each case where that happens is another one of experience that helps in the long term. Now, again, I'm also struck by the way that the diocese and archdiocese of the United States are very much determined to provide as much pastoral and emotional and psychological care to the victims.
Yep.
And that's been an area of development over the last 20 years.
And that's an extremely crucial point to make, Matthew, that the church in the U.S. is, in fact, the global gold standard for handling these issues. It's not just the Catholic Church across the world that's been encountering this. Numerous other institutions have these issues, but the Catholic Church has been leading the fight in terms of responding to it. And to that end, I want to bring up this bill that's happening in Montana. And
you know well
what I'm about to say. I know the intent is to protect children and whatnot, but the potential request of breaking the seal of the confessional violates fundamental religious tenets, let alone First Amendment rights.
Well, that's right. So the bill that you're talking about, it was flagged just a few days ago by a Montana representative by the name of Lucas Schubert, who is himself a Catholic and a vigorous opponent of this bill. And he began talking about this on his own X feed, or posting on X, or what used to be Twitter. I'm still not sure how we should call these things. But the point he was making was that this is a proposed bill that would eliminate clergy exemption in mandatory reporting of child abuse and neglect. So in other words, it states that clergy and others in the mandatory reporting groups, such as medical practitioners and social workers, may not refuse to make a report as required on the grounds of physician, patient, or similar privilege.
Right.
Now, clergy are often mandatory reporters outside of the confessional, but longstanding legal precedent in the U.S. certainly recognizes, under things like the ministerial exception and others, that the religious freedom of confessors and penitents, that they are exempt from those rules. Now, there are those who would say, well, that's ridiculous. That is something that we hold to be absolutely sacred, that the sanctity of the seal of confession. And again, it's longstanding precedent. Clergy members are mandatory reporters of child abuse or neglect in Montana. Even though current Montana law upholds the priest penitent privilege, it does also require that a member of the clergy or priest may not, without the consent of the person making the confession, be examined as to any confession made to the individual.
Yep.
So again, these are things that have been tested previously, and from the Catholic standpoint, it's additionally important to maintain that seal for the obvious sacramental reasons, but also the code of canon law in the church stipulates quite clearly that any priest who violates the sacramental seal incurs excommunication. So it puts priests in an almost impossible position.
Yeah, it truly does. I personally have spoken to numerous priests who work with anywhere from especially victims in terms of being mandatory reporters. Not one of them have ever gone forth saying that what we need is a violation of the seal of the confessional, because the sacredness of the seal is an inherent part of that sacramental reality. So the fact that the state even believes that they have a right to infringe upon that is baffling.
Yeah, precisely. Now, this isn't the first time we've had discussions along these lines in places as far distant as Ireland. They have been floated in Australia. We also know that there were several efforts just in the U.S., for example, in Delaware a couple of years ago, and in Vermont, looking at similar requirements for priests to break the seal of confession. those bills, the ones in, again, Delaware and Vermont, failed to advance, partly because they knew that realistically they're not going to pass any form of constitutional scrutiny. But it's interesting, too, and this is often overlooked, is that this priest-penitent privilege isn't exclusively for Catholics, which is an argument that some make, that Catholics are trying to use this as a dodge for themselves. In fact, a number of Protestant denominations, such as the Episcopalian Church, also have similar rights or privileges regarding the secrecy of their version of confession.
Right. So let's pivot. We're running out of time in this segment. Just very quickly, Cardinal Schönborn's resignation was accepted by Pope Francis, so his term as bishop has come to an end.
It has. This is something of an end of an era in German-speaking Catholic world. As the Archbishop of Vienna, he was one of the most prominent churchmen in Europe. But let's remember, too, his legacy. He will be remembered as one of the great protégés of Pope Benedict XVI, of Joseph Ratzinger, and one of the drafters of the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly, in recent years, he has said a few controversial things, but that legacy is one I think that everyone will remember.
Yep, I think it's cemented in history, and there's no doubt about it. He's done so much in terms of the teaching office of the Church alone that it's hard to remember him for anything else. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with us, Matthew.
Yeah, great to be with you, and keep all of the Marchers for Life in your prayers tomorrow.
Will do. Keep warm.
Too late.
My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. We've been talking about church news, current events in light of church teaching. Please stay on the coverage of EWTN for the March for Life, and we will be talking about it tomorrow on Ave Maria in the afternoon. Stay tuned.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I went to Las Vegas years and years ago for one of these cable shows. And I was shocked to see all these old ladies in their 70s and 80s getting off that plane, running for a slot machine. You don't have a chance to win. They're all fixed. I know, my uncle used to have slot machines.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
How do we listen to God? Contrary to popular opinion that God only speaks to the privileged few, the Catholic Catechism tells us He communicates to all of us through our conscience. On our hearts, in our most secret core, God has inscribed the moral law. This law calls man to live and to do what is good and avoid evil. In the aloneness of the sanctuary that is our conscience, our Creator's voice echoes in our depths. When he listens to his conscience, says the Catechism, the prudent man can hear God speaking. Conscience is a judgment of reason whereby the human person recognizes the moral quality of a concrete act about to be performed, is already performing, or has already been performed. John Henry Cardinal Newman defined conscience as the law of the mind whereby God speaks to us behind a veil. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Italy aficionado Teresa Tomio's newest book is coming soon to the Ave Maria online store. In Italy's Shrines and Wonders, Teresa Tomio provides how best to navigate the most popular sites, best routes, and how to best soak in all the beauty Italy has to offer. She also shares the most inspiring journeys to make your Italy excursion utterly unforgettable. Shrines and Wonders from Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomio, will be found soon at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. When the British Parliament learned of the infamous Boston Tea Party, it responded with a series of measures designed to rein in that insubordinate seaport town. The colonists' response laid the groundwork for the American Revolution. We look at how these early years transformed the American spirit and identity. We're joined by Sean McGee, who is a political historian of 18th and 19th century America, educator in the Philadelphia metropolitan area, and author of No Longer Subjects of the British King, The Political Transformation of Royal Subjects into Republican Citizens. Sean, it is great to speak with you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Marcus. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
So, when we think about the Boston Tea Party, I think because of retrospective sentiment, it's so, and you know, plays like Hamilton really don't do the political milieu justice. It seems like the Sons of Liberty was this ragtag group of individuals who wanted to stick it to Parliament and to show them that we could self-govern. But the truth of the matter is there were certain things that were done by Parliament to bring Boston to that point where they needed to respond.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think that for quite some time, Parliament neglected the internal governance of colonial America, at least the 13 mainland colonies. And we see over the course of at least the 18th century a real political confidence and political legitimacy develop at the local level. And we have a situation where local men are electing local men to local offices to solve local problems. And it turns out, you know, that more often than not, colonial leadership is competent and colonial leadership develops a confidence over time. And after the French and Indian War, we see a more assertive Parliament that begins to, you know, try to interfere with internal governance in colonial America. That's sort of really where this all starts.
Yep. You think about, for example, the Coercive Act of 1774, and it's very clear that the British Parliament were taking stances willfully to be punitive, to punish Massachusetts, to punish Boston. And they wanted to make an example of Boston, but it seems like the underlying premise here was that in Massachusetts would be the rise and fall of the obedience of all the other colonies in America.
Yeah, I think you're reading that correct as well. I think that on the ground we hear right away that other colonists from, you know, from all over New England and the Mid-Atlantic colonies and the Southern colonies, there's a real palpable fear that if Parliament is aggressive enough to crush the economy and destroy the charter of Massachusetts, then it would certainly have no problem doing the same thing to subsequent colonies. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, like Parliament's always, you know, a couple months behind responding to what's going on in colonial America.
Right.
And I think that not only Parliament, I don't think anyone was really prepared for just how rapidly unified a very, you know, not quite a majority, but a sizable percentage of the colonial population would become because of Parliament's interference in local governance.
So in the sense of responding to Parliament's interference, to, in this case, colonial governance, local governance, there was a rise of a kind of political community and a rise of... It was burgeoning at that point. It took some time to refine, but a development of a political ideal that would spearhead what we eventually know as the American Revolution.
Yeah, I don't think anybody could have predicted that. Mm-hmm. But that's certainly what the end result is. I think first and foremost, the really concerned Whig leadership. Yeah. They were concerned with. Like gaining back local regulatory authority from a parliament that they didn't feel was accountable to colonists. I mean, some of these lessons, they stretch back into the late 17th century after the 1688 Glorious Revolution.
Right.
When Parliament overthrows the last Catholic king, and effectively makes certain that moving forward, only Parliament has the authority to tax, and specifically the House of Commons, the elected representatives. And I think the lesson that colonists, learned was not that Parliament could tax them, but only the people that they could themselves elect into office.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a similar lesson, but not an identical lesson. And so on one side of the Atlantic, it's only the House of Commons who are elected. And on the other side of the Atlantic, it's only people who are elected. Thus, legitimately only people from, say, Virginia can tax from Virginia is the lesson that they learn. And in order to reassert that form of local governance, we have this sort of unified pan-colonial resistance movement that does, as you mentioned earlier, develop into a revolutionary and ultimately independence movement.
Right. Because in response to these retaliatory measures, New England, Georgia, they began first by expressing verbal sympathy, but also eventually support, because the concern here was subjugation to the point of enslaving of British America by essentially the British Crown and British Parliament.
Yeah, this goes back to a lost intellectual world, one that, like we hear the mantra all the time, no taxation without representation.
Mm-hmm.
But we can say that in the 21st century, but, not a whole lot of us fully appreciate what that meant in the 18th century. And so when they say, when they're, howling about, so we have to remember, the Boston Tea Party happened as a result not only because of a tea tax,
mm-hmm.
but because of a tea tax that lowered taxes for tea. So Americans got fired up about their taxes being reduced.
Mm-hmm.
That suggests very strongly, I believe, that it was never about the price of taxation, but rather the principle, who has the authority to take people's property. And back then, property was a range of things. It wasn't just money. Taxation could be a range of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Paying in kind. And if you have a politically unaccountable parliament, and what I mean by that is a parliament that no one in the colonies can elect, and I think more importantly, cast out of office through the ballot, that asserts the authority to take your property, then you're threatening people's independence, right? Someone's property is their ability to be an independent actor in the world, both economically and politically. And if Parliament can tax without being checked, without being held accountable in the ballot box, they could tax people out of independence and into the opposite of that, which is dependence, or the word that they use more often, slavery.
Right. And that's why Edmund Pendleton of Virginia rightly had his finger on the pulse when he said that what's going on here. He could read the anxiety that was burgeoning in Massachusetts, and he called it a common attack on American rights, because he saw that what's at stake here is nothing short of the dignity of individuals and persons within the colonies.
That's 100% correct, and anyone of the Whig persuasion would have agreed with that wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
There is, of course, the what I call in the book imperial traditionalists. We typically call them loyalists, but there's not yet a conflict. There's not exactly a war yet, so I refer to them as imperial traditionalists. They have, they still have an issue with the coercive acts. They have an issue with Parliament asserting a certain authority. But they have an even bigger issue with a portion of colonial America, claiming that they can sort of thwart the will of Parliament and challenge the sovereignty of King and Parliament.
Yeah. You consider, for example, George Washington's response to the whole thing. His description of Boston, for example, and Boston's suffering as the suffering of all the other colonies in America. And in fact, the indication at the very least that the attack upon Boston was an attack upon liberty and the property of the people of Boston and therefore the American colonies.
Yeah, and Washington even adds a further element to that. There's a great line that I discovered in one of his letters where he's writing to a sort of friend of his in Virginia, where he says, if we don't, I'm paraphrasing here, but it's something like, if we don't resist these efforts by the Parliament in attacking our rights, we will become as tame and as abject slaves as the blacks we rule over so arbitrarily.
Mm.
So he's reaching into a language that specifically Southern gentlemen would understand and shudder at.
Right. My guest, Sean McGee, political historian of 18th and 19th century America, and he is the author of No Longer Subjects of the British King, The Political Transformation of Royal Subjects to Republican Citizens. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
The most amazing saints from modern times, John Paul II, Maximilian Kolbe, and Maria Faustina with the Divine Mercy. This is Steve Ray. We invite you to join us on a pilgrimage to Poland and experience this incredible Catholic country, the land of saints, Catholic culture, gorgeous churches and shrines, and delicious food. Join us next April as we again visit Poland, one of our favorite pilgrimage destinations.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
60 Seconds with Father Mitch Pacwa.
The state has responsibility to orient things, but they can't take over the rights of the family, like in China, to have one child and that's it. It's a disaster over there. How many tens of millions of abortions have gone on? And one of the things that, as a result of that, is because of the preference to have boy children rather than girls, you have, for every 1,000 boys, there are 850 girls. This is a great imbalance. Same thing is going on in northern India. So this is where the government cannot take away the primary and inalienable responsibility of married couples and families. And they cannot employ methods which fail to respect the person and fundamental human rights. Beginning with the right to life, the government cannot force you to kill innocent human beings and still be a humanistic government. It's an evil government.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
How can we be sure our conscience is guiding us rightly? The Catholic Catechism states that in order to make correct moral judgments, we must have a well-formed conscience, one that is upright, truthful, and formulates its judgments according to reason and conforms them to the true good willed by the wisdom of the Creator. In order to avoid the trap of negative influences and the desire to prefer our own judgments, we must educate our conscience. The Catechism asserts that prudent education teaches virtue and guarantees freedom and engenders peace of heart. What are the ingredients of this educational stew? The Word of God, which we absorb through faith and prayer and an examination of conscience before the Lord's cross. Though our modern world sometimes makes discernment difficult, a well-formed conscience helps us see what is right and choose what is the will of God as expressed in divine law. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Sean McGee, author of No Longer Subjects of the British King, The Political Transformation of Royal Subjects to Republican Citizens. And we're talking about those events that essentially led to the American Revolution and all those freedoms and benefits that we enjoy as a nation today. So, Sean, when we left off, we were talking about those initial events that catalyzed particular movements, and a series of dominoes would fall that would eventually lead to the calling of the Continental Congress. Just describe what that was like in terms of the political milieu of the time.
So there was real hope and expectation. There's real enthusiasm for calling what many of the commentators referred to then as a Grand Continental Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And they were hoping to gather the collective wisdom of all of the colonies. I mean, it's one of the earliest moments where commentators in print media are really beginning to think about the 13 colonies as a sort of collective, right? Like we're not quite there yet, but we're beginning to see a sort of proto-nationalism where
right.
Each colony is saying, you know, we need to get the best guys in one space to convene in a Grand Continental Congress. And so they're recognizing that there's wisdom beyond their own borders. There's real potential value in coming together as a broad committee that can address the current crisis of the realm.
Mm-hmm.
And reading the newspaper accounts, it's sort of consumes the news cycle. I mean, when delegates are eventually selected through a variety of means in the different colonies, just reporting the movement of delegates, it becomes the news cycle, and it sort of invites readers into a broader imperial drama.
Right.
And these men are fed it, and they're, you know, there's some pretty heroic writing about them. You know, they're a collection of wiser men hasn't come together.
Mm-hmm.
Since the first Charles. You know, we're referring to the English Civil Wars. So there's real excitement that a collection of men specifically from multiple colonies will be able to convene and with their collective wisdom solve the problems of the realm, bring about imperial reconciliation, and what I argue in the book, moral purification.
Right. And that's so crucial because this notion of moral purification starts bubbling up, especially with, in light of this Continental Congress, the fact that they're now able to socialize with members and delegates of other parts of the colonies. And they start realizing that they are united by a common cause. This element of socializing that you highlight is not one that we ought to take for granted.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that one of the most exciting moments that I had in researching this, and this is like a really elementary thought, but you know, there are no radios then, right? There's no
That's
photographs.
Right.
There's no television. Like even
there's
when
no telephone.
Men, yeah, there's no tell. They don't know what each other. They don't know what they look like,
mm-hmm.
right? So you could be passing a delegate. You could be from Rhode Island and pass a delegate from you know like Maryland, and you would have no idea that you were passing a delegate.
Right.
I mean, the only delegates that had anything approaching like a colonial wide reputation was probably Dickinson from Pennsylvania, who wrote the famous Farmer's Letters, mm-hmm. and probably Washington from French and Indian War fame, and that's really about the extent of it. But they did meet, they did convene, and there's I think very important stories that unfold once they do in fact meet in Philadelphia.
And so when they gathered together, undoubtedly, and again, you, like I mentioned, you rightly highlight this, undoubtedly, sentiments of loyalty to the crown still persisted. And yet, the commitment to liberty, the dignity of the individual, endowed rights by the creator, those were things that undergirded the sentiments of all those gathered at that Congress. And so they had to grapple with that before coming to what history will remember as a rather radical approach to the response to the British Parliament.
Yeah, I don't think anyone really recognized just how radical that convening itself was.
Right.
When, you know, and I write this in the book, like when we think about radicalism, we think about real radicals, like, you know, firebrands like Patrick Henry and
right.
Sam Adams. You don't think of George Washington as a radical. no one ever thought of, like, you know, some of these guys, like Peyton Randolph, like that guy's the opposite of radical. But
right.
looking at the individuals rather than the decisions they made as a collective sort of obscures just the radical nature of the Congress, because as far as I can tell, they took some breathtakingly dangerous steps. You know, we look at this in hindsight. We know that the American Revolution was ultimately a success. Maybe they didn't accomplish everything that they set out to accomplish, but they did accomplish independence. But history is not—it's not lived looking backwards. It's lived looking forward.
Mm-hmm.
These men were risking their lives. It was very dangerous business that they were up to.
Yep. And as someone who came from the British Commonwealth, I can attest to the fact that this sense of the divinely endowed right of, in this case, the Windsors, to continue to rule the British throne, it's kind of ingrained still. And so to think about that First Continental Congress, essentially standing for individual liberty and therefore hoping to stand for those very things that they believe God had endowed upon the human person, meant that they were willing to stand against the earlier purported doctrine of the divine right of the British crown to rule over them.
Yeah, I think that's where we begin to see, many of them were willing to go an extra step, and, you know, the separation from the king and parliament gets really dangerous when they begin to tell, and this litters the records, that the letters that they're writing one another, the records of Congress. There's this sort of mythologized history that many of these delegates believed that in fact it was an oppressive king and parliament that caused their forefathers to escape England
right.
proper to begin with, and they came across a dangerous ocean and settled a savage and wild land at a great expense of blood and treasure. And here's the key. This is really dangerous language, and not every one of the Continental Congress agreed with this language, but most of them did. When they decided to set up governments to protect their lives and their property, they voluntarily maintained a connection to the king, but never to Parliament.
Right.
Now, whether or not this is historically accurate that doesn't matter, because, you know, sometimes the truth and the facts aren't the same thing. You act on the truth. And that was their truth, right? That their forefathers came across at great risk, risked everything, set up this government, and decided to voluntarily remain members of the realm.
That's right. And therefore, these American Whigs, they profess publicly, and by the way, there was a true appeal here to the Christian scriptures. There was a kind of cultural, socio-religious context that drove their beliefs, their ideals, and therefore the thrust forward. But they're professing loyalty here to continent, to Congress, to colony, rather than, in this case, Parliament, and therefore, by extension, King and Crown. And like you mentioned, the cost of this would have been to be publicly hung, drawn, and quartered. This is essentially high treason, and they were willing to pay that price.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's one of the things that we forget about. I think, you know, we often forget about, you know, my book doesn't even get to the war, but we often, like, it's either airbrushed out of our popular narratives or it's just something that's forgotten in the national consciousness. The war devolved into a dangerous, violent process.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just the beginning of that process. And these men did not know that process was going to end with success. In fact, you know, there were betting lines when the war starts in Europe about how long the Americans would last and what their odds were of winning and that sort of thing. Like, they were the odds on underdogs.
Right.
And they were still willing to put on paper that there's a certain belief system. And the part of my book, one of my main original arguments, is that they valued community self-preservation over continued inclusion in the empire, right? They want to be loyal to the king. They're never loyal. They never write a letter to Parliament, right?
Mm-hmm.
They write a petition to the king. They never bother to write one to Parliament, which suggests to me that most of those delegates never believed that Parliament had any legitimate control over them anyway.
Right.
Their connection to Britain was through the king and through the king only.
And so when they write these resolutions in the summer leading up to the convening of Congress, and when Congress finally writes its finished product, the Articles of Association, they are claiming that their fundamental right of any community leader is to defend the public goods and pre-existing rights and to pass them on inviolate to posterity.
That's right.
And they want to remain loyal to the king, but if remaining loyal to the king means that they're going to lose some of those rights and their posterity will have fewer liberties than they did, then their continued inclusion in the empire is not important.
Right. And that's precisely why, when you think about the brand of patriotism that was espoused as a result of the Continental Congress, of the Articles of Association, initially the purpose here was willful material self-denial for the sake of resistance that was economic. It provided social pressure against especially Parliament, but they were willing to undergo the potential risk of organized war-driven violence, and that's what it eventually devolved into and became, and yet they were willing to pay that price because they recognize the perennial heritage of what they were fighting for.
Yeah, these are men that for their, you know, they're different denominations of Protestantism. There's actually one Catholic from Maryland, Charles Carroll,
yep,
who was denied the right to be an actual delegate. But he does go to Congress as sort of an advisor, if I'm not mistaken, for Maryland. But nevertheless, like despite their denominational differences, these are men who are drawn together, that they're still connected by Enlightenment thought. They're still connected by, you know, some of their interests in science and some of their interests in politics and political theory. But like really unites them in general is that there's this persistent and general belief that Providence, or as Washington would call it, the grand architect of the universe, endowed humanity with certain rights and dignities and liberties, and it was up to them to make certain that the next generation had them inviolate.
Sean, I need you to know I would continue to have this conversation with you for hours, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much, Marcus. You might have another doctoral degree in your future. You're a careful reader.
Thank you. My guest, Sean McGee, political historian of 18th, 19th century, author of No Longer Subjects to the British King. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.